I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
That's what happens when you pick those babes up at 2 o'clock in the morning when the bar is real dark. You end up with a horse in your bed, or at least a part of the horse in your head bed. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker again, as usual, like every day but Sunday. Yeah, we're at P.O. Box 401 as usual, 46581, our international galactical phone number. In case you want to leave a message or get in touch with me, 641-715-3800. And the code for that, then you put in 56890. And I'm beginning to check that line every day, because once in a while when I go too long and there's an important call on there and I miss it. So I'll be checking it every day or every other day. So if you want to send me a message and put it on there, and if you got new information and news, late breaking news, as Fox TV would say, put it on there. Or if you know somebody that doesn't have a computer, doesn't want to use a computer, well, they can just simply have a recording on a cassette tape or a CD and put the phone up to the loudspeaker and record some useful information right on there. And we'll get it. It works. I've done it many times. Well, it's August the 13th today. And we had a meteor shower last night. I guess you heard about it on the news. I didn't get up and go out and look at it. I was a little lazy there, and I just went to sleep. Yeah. So anyhow, I think it's supposed to be tonight, too, a meteor shower.
Thor, Norse god of thunder. A fearless warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor.
Yeah, that's what today is, Thor's Day. The mighty Thor who battled those simian monsters, or those reptilian monsters back then. I think they were talking even back then maybe about powerful Jews. Yeah. I was listening on the radio coming back from town this morning from the gym, and I heard them talking about what a terrible plight young people have now of costing thousands and thousands of dollars, and they go in debt just to get a bachelor's degree. And even after they get a bachelor's degree, they can't get a job because some of these places like McDonald's are requiring bachelor's degree or better to get a damn job in a hamburger shop. Well, why don't people figure this out? A lot of them have, I'm sure. But you see, it's in the best interest of the corporations in a country to promote low-cost education, maybe free education, because who are you? What are you doing it for? Why do you want people to become educated, especially in science and so forth? Well, because they're going to be the future of the country. And you're going to need very smart, educated people. So why would the corporations in the United States not do that? Well, it's very simple. They don't have to. They're building trade schools all over the third world. All these black holes of Calcutta and so forth. The corporations go over there. They build trade schools to teach low-cost workers just exactly what they want them to know and not anymore. So they don't give them a broad education. They just give them an education into the piece of electronic equipment or the field that they're wanting to do this. And so, of course, this is all done with people who are... their income is very, very low, let me put it that way. Yeah, that's the way the game is played. I mean, first they ship the companies out with all the jobs out, and then they build trade schools and so forth, and import some of the people that have gained educations in those countries, and come over here, and they'll work for, you know, a lot less. Well, yeah, of course. So what they're telling you is it's people replacement, technician replacement, working class replacement, and they don't need you anymore, Whitey. Or if you're sharp, a blackie too, you know, or even an American-born Asian. So that's your problem. Now, once you know that, and the fact that then a lot of people join up in the military just to get a job, and supposedly they're going to give you an education after you get out if you live through it. Yeah, nice. Isn't it? So when I call these filthy bastard, corrupt sons of bitches that should be hung by the neck until dead, or even better, have the Madame Guillotine out there and do them in, and they'll eventually have to be done in if you're going to survive. I don't give a shit how many federal agents are listening to this show. It's just survival of the fittest, and if the race is going to survive at some point, they're going to have to quit worrying about, you don't like Negroes, you offend these people. And they're going to be running for the hills because people are going to be chasing them with hatchets or machetes or guillotines on a trailer. That's the way it's going to be. Otherwise, so long there, Mr. White Man and Woman and Child. You're going to degenerate. Keep going down, down, down until there's nothing left. And you'll be total slaves. Like the sign on my political sign out front of my house. Free men discriminate. Slaves cannot. Boy, I'll tell you, I'm getting a lot of people reading that when they go by. And we have hundreds of students that go by here too. And I wonder if they're taking it over to school and saying, "Hey, Miss Teacher, what the hell's he mean? He said this thing here. I don't understand that." She'll say, "Oh, don't pay any attention to that. Don't listen to that. He's a Nazi. He's a neo-Nazi. He's a Klansman. He's a racist. He's a white supremacist." But teacher, it makes common sense. It's logical. "Oh, no, no, no. They always lie. Those guys always lie." So anyhow, if people with half a brain haven't caught on to what's happened to us in our white society, I don't know what the hell else could be done to wake them up. I just don't see it. Every piece of advertising you see on television is promoting race mixing. Now there's more non-whites in the advertisements than there are whites. And they're also adding couples with non-white kids. And I saw one ad where they were advertising some shit, and a guy and a gal came home with an adopted nigger baby. And they made a big deal. This is in an ad. In an ad. They were showing that these people adopted a nigger baby. So, my clock goes tick, tick, tick. And I say, worse is better for now. But it can't go on forever. There's going to have to be a Katie by the door shut, there's a man under the bed. Get the machete. Yeah. Well, let's get back into Terror in the Night by Jack Nelson, the Klan's campaign against the Jews. Now, there's something can come out of this that's very good, this educational process of reading these books, because I want you to be making mental notes of where, who did what wrong and who did what right, where the or even grade the feds on how badly or how good they did. Or the Klansmen, how was their security, this and that. These are, I'm not reading this for my health. You're supposed to be analyzing what I'm reading and educating yourself on, well, I wouldn't do it again that way, I'd do it a different way. Because if you're reading about the losses of the Klan and they keep on doing the same thing, well, that's insanity. You got to learn to try new things and straighten out your mistakes. Now, in case you have any glimmer of respect for these federal authorities, you're a fool, because they're racial war criminals. They have been racial war criminals for decades and decades. You got to get that through your head and get this thing in the back of your head, well, they're the authorities and they got to be partly good. No, they don't have to be partly good. The program is all bad. All bad. And every division of government now has been totally overturned. We imported all the bad things from the Soviet Union. We rejected all the good things that were in the Soviet Union, and we imported all the bad things. Okay, so don't forget now, if you're just listening to me and then forgetting everything I'm saying, you're not going anywhere. But if you're thinking about it and analyzing it and say, hey, he made a good point there, or oh man, that was a bad point, you get educated so that when the crap comes to your door, you know what to do, you know what to think. You got to be prepared ahead of time. You can't wait till the last minute and educate yourself on intelligence gathering, snitches, informants, the equipment they use and all that. You can't wait till then. It's too late, you know. So, anyhow, here we go, Thursday, and we're back to the book. Early in 1968, the FBI office in Meridian, Mississippi, began to receive intelligence reports that the White Knights were altering their strategy. Which I say is intelligent. You change your strategy from time to time. If you stick to one strategy, you're going to fail. Feeling the heat after terrorizing Jackson's Jewish community, the Klan was now planning to shift its campaign to Meridian, more than 80 miles to the east. In a secret meeting with an informant, whoa, there you go, boys. Agent Frank Watts learned that the Klan had drawn up a Meridian hit list. Now, how many people should have a hit list in a group if you were into that kind of thing? Of course, this is all imaginary. How many people should have a copy of the hit list? Answer, one. Nobody else should have it at all. So they were probably talking about this list in their meetings. Bad mistake. The informant pulled a slip of paper out of his pocket and handed it to Watts. On the paper was a column of names scrawled in pencil. Meridian's police chief, Roy Gunn, headed the list. followed by business mayor Davidson, I.A. Rosenblum. You see, there shouldn't be any lists. Should all be in the memory, period. No lists. Al Rose and several other prominent Meridian Jews. Then Watts saw a name that jumped off the page at him. It was his own. Watts blamed Gunn. The chief had gone around town boasting that he was working with Frank Watts and the FBI, that they were not going to let the Klan get away with any of this violence crap. It was that kind of babbling by the police. If you see that two sides can play the game. You have your people next to the police department, inside the police department, whatever, and you hear what's going on in there. They're trying to infiltrate and inform on you, and you're doing the same thing to them. It was that kind of babbling by the police chief, Watts told his fellow agents, that no doubt had landed them both on the hit list. Watts, who was a resident agent in Meridian, but reported to Moore and Ingram of the Jackson Field office, did not take the list lightly. He had a wife and three boys. Well, you see, when the worm turns, people get a little excited, huh? You come after us, we come after you. Oh, that's a whole different ball game. Given the way the Klan operated, his family was in at least as much danger as he was. He wasted no time calling his partner, Jack Rooker. The Klan's putting out a list, he told Rooker. And would you believe it? I'm on it. We've got to get busy and do a better job infiltrating this bunch of thugs. And if we're going to get anywhere, it looks like we've just got to fight fire with fire. They play tough, we play tough. Yes, and that goes vice versa. You guys are the invaders, even if you've lived there all your life. If you're trying to destroy the Southern culture, then you're the invader. You're the aggressor. They decided to contact Tom Hendricks, the former FBI agent who represented Alton Wayne Roberts and his brother Raymond, both notorious Klansmen that turned out to be heavy-duty paid informants. The FBI had turned a corner in the war against the Klan. Well, no, it was against the South. It was just the Klan was outspoken and activist. Meridian seemed made to order for Sam Bowers. The town and surrounding Piney Woods area were already fertile recruiting grounds for the White Knights. The FBI's Meridian office was skeletal compared to the Jackson Field office. More important, Meridian itself had a raw side. Once the commercial and cultural hub of the state, it had become a city in which violence simmered so close to the surface that a surprising number of people carried guns, including such unlikely candidates as Reverend R.S. Porter, pastor of the all-black First Union Baptist Church. Well, why didn't he depend on Jesus to protect him? I don't understand that. Lucille Rosenbaum, the diminutive but outspoken school board president, and Tom Bordeaux, the courtly, soft-spoken lawyer who headed one of the town's oldest families. After proposing during the golden age of rail transportation, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, Meridian declined along with the railroads in the years just before and after World War II. At its zenith, a bustling rail junction, retail center, and marketing hub for cotton and lumber. Downtown Meridian by the 60s was parched and down at the heels. The streets were nearly devoid of trees. Weeds poked through the cracks in the sidewalks. I think like Detroit. Weidman's, the town's best-known restaurant and favorite out-of-town reporters covering the civil rights story hung out there, was busy with locals during the day, but at night it was empty as the downtown streets. The once elegant hotels, which had accommodated hundreds of travelers at night and boasted of their sumptuous dining rooms, were now vacant and sad. and the opera house was boarded up. The opera house built by Jewish merchants as a public service and graced by Caruso and Galli Curci and Sarah Bernhardt, in a flowering of high culture unmatched anywhere in the South except New Orleans. Tucked out of sight were some attractive residential neighborhoods and a great deal of money, but the once proud Queen City of Mississippi contrasted poorly with the capital city of Jackson, with its busy offices and grand, well-tended parks. Along with the blacks and native Protestants, Meridian had a large Irish Catholic population and a deep-rooted Jewish community. The Irish built the railroads and operated and maintained the shops, the ice houses, and the cotton compressors. And as they did in many American cities, they stayed to dominate its politics. My family always had a joke, said Bill Reedy, the bluff Irishman who represented Meyer Davidson and persuaded him and his wife to evacuate their evidence the night of the bombing threat. Meridian was a weird place because it is populated by Baptists and other illiterates, financed and owned by the Jewish community. But the government has always been run by Catholics. The only people excluded were the blacks. Meridian prosperous Jewish citizens were integrated into the larger community in a way that Jackson Jews could only dream of. In 1882, Meridian City Director listed 50 telephone exchanges, and although Jews were only a small percentage of the population, 9 of those exchanges belonged to Jewish firms. According to Leo and Evelyn Turitz, Jews in early Mississippi, Meridian's Jews went into business with the Gentiles, Aryans, sat on the boards of banks and brokerages, and were treated like the leading citizens they were. Along Meridian's main thoroughfare, many of the buildings still bear the names of their Jewish merchant owners. The Rosenbaum Building, the Arkey Building, the Winter and Meyer Building, the tallest structure in town, the 17-story, 3-foot building, was named after one of the oldest Jewish families in Meridian, the Threefoots, whose name translates from the German Dreyfus. During Meridian's heyday, the Marx-Rothenberg family, 3 brothers and a half-brother, opened what soon became a thriving department store. Isaac Marx and his brothers built the opera house next to their store and operated it for years on a non-profit basis. Israel Marx donated land to the Highland Park. A statue of him still stands there. 2 brothers from another prominent family, Joseph and Samuel Mayer, built the city's first skyscraper, the 11-story Lamar Hotel, famous for its excellent cuisine. All were German Jews whose fathers, mostly small-town shopkeepers and traders, had fled their native Bohemia to escape the anti-Jewish riots that broke out after the failed rebellion against Habsburg's rule in 1848. The German Jews were assimilationists by nature. And that's what I keep telling you. The danger of the Jew is how he does assimilate. He worms his way into every strata, every class, and every race. And that's what they're taught to do. Not to separate. You know, there's a certain percentage, of course, the ultra-Orthodox and so forth, that separate. But the dangerous ones are actually the assimilationists. Unless they can break completely clean of Judaism and all of that kind of stuff. Secular and later waves of poorly educated but pious Jews who would pour into America from Eastern Europe in the late 1800s. Growing up as Southerners, as Eli Evans wrote in The Provincials, German Jews would absorb the regional defiance and unrestrained pride, the memories of rising to sing Dixie in the grammar school assemblies and in history class, the surging poignance on reading Lee's farewell to his troops. Anti-Jewism was virtually unheard of in Meridian. This remained true even in the wake of the Leo Frank lynching in 1915, which brought the latent feelings against Jews much closer to the surface elsewhere in the South. Well, I knew a guy who was in on that lynching. Yeah, he was 90-some years old when I knew him. And it was obvious that the governor was going to let this Leo Frank rapist go. And a group of men decided, no, that's not going to happen. So they broke into the jail and dragged him out and hung him. Like I say, I knew this man that had been involved in that. Actually, he was an Irishman from the north. And his wife lived to be 90-some years old, too. He told me one day he was walking, having a walk, going to work on the sidewalk, and he ran into a guy that turned out to be Woodrow Wilson that lived in the general area. As the city fought against decline, the children of its Jewish families tended to drift away. They preferred practicing law or medicine to tending their father's retail store. Well, they're always encouraged to do that. It's not necessarily their idea to break away, but Jews always are pushing their kids to be doctors, lawyers, bankers, and like that. In other words, you don't have to have a majority of the population to control the country. You just get key positions, whether it's in finance or in the law or in the media or whatever. You just get key positions, the gateways, and you can take over and handle any country. They moved to Jackson or Atlanta or even the north. The few who remained lived unpretentious lives of quiet comfort despite their wealth. It was these rich, still prominent Jews living in the same town with top foot soldiers of the White Knights that made Sam Bowers focus his sights on Meridian. At the beginning of 1968, the Klan's activities in Meridian aroused little reaction from local Jews or the white community in general. For the most part, the attacks were directed against black churches, housing Head Start centers, and individuals who had offended the Klan in specific ways. Two church bombings in January and one in early February were not mentioned by the Meridian Star, the usual practice of newspapers in Mississippi when it came to crimes against blacks. Then on February 20th, the Klansmen burned a grocery operated by a one-time Meridian police sergeant, Wallace Miller. Miller was not considered one of Meridian's brightest policemen. Chief Gunn liked to say that you could take a five-acre field, get a bucket of manure, dig a hole and put the manure in it and cover it up, and Wallace would find it and step in it. Unquote. But Miller was a former member of the White Knights who had become an FBI informant and a key witness in the Philadelphia case. He had implicated Bowers in the killing of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman and had given crucial testimony about the details. Again, too many cooks spoil the broth. I mean, I wonder how many people were on that job that got these three civil wrongs workers. They probably had a half a dozen people or more for a job that only required one, maximum two. I know the FBI's out there saying, oh, this is obviously what he's planning, but I don't have any dam, or I don't know if there's a dam around here to bury anybody in or not. Considering the temperature and the mood of the nation, I'm more likely to be killed and buried in a dam than the blacks. A few days later, according to the FBI records, White Knights put the torch to the New Hope Baptist Church, site of the Head Start program and civil rights activities. The next night, Knight Riders fired a shotgun into the home of J.R. Moore, a black school bus driver for Head Start and set fire to the parsonage of the New Old Chapter Methodist Church, another Head Start. Would you call these great strategic targets in a war? I sure as hell wouldn't. In fact, that kind of stuff works just the opposite. I know they say, oh, well, they're spreading terrorism, but that doesn't scare the ruling class. It doesn't scare the government officials. That doesn't scare the crooked governors and senators and congressmen. No. It scares a few of these people living in these working class neighborhoods, black or white, but not the ones that need to be really scared. Let's see here. There was something I was going to say about that, too. The only incident directed against blacks that got prominent play in the paper was an attack on the house of Dr. Hobart Corngay, a well-known dentist, and one of two blacks included in the official history of Lauderdale County. Corngay, his wife Ernestine, a schoolteacher, and their two daughters were all at home around 9 o'clock one night when a shotgun blast ripped through the house. One of the daughters in her room doing homework screamed that she'd been shot. It turned out that she had been hit by flying glass. Well, so what? They fired a crossbow through my front window into my recliner chair about 6 inches above my head, only missed me by 6 inches. And then all the other attempts and things that they did. You didn't read about that in the national paper. I don't even think they printed anything about it in the local Fallbrook, California paper. So when a friend of mine was doing ride along with the sheriffs, they found out about it and there was also attempted firebombing. He said they wanted to come over and investigate, and I told him his name was Rusty. He's dead now. But I said, forget it. I don't want those bastards coming over here tramping through my house, looking to see whatever they can see, maybe try to find something illegal laying around. They would never have found it, but they would try. That's what they try to do. You got to understand that. They want to get access to your house. If they know you're a white racist and something's happened to you or somebody's thrown rocks through your window like that, they don't want to come over there with an idea of catching the people. Oh, they'll go through the motions and they'll pretend. But the main thing, they might find somebody, a lowlife that they can arrest. But in reality, they want into your house. They want to be looking around. You see it all the time in the news. Cops go into a house about maybe a husband and wife fight and suddenly see some marijuana laying around or something. And all of a sudden, they're all in jail. So, if you're going to have a problem and you want to solve it yourself, if it's that important. I wasn't going to run all over three counties looking for some guy with a crossbow that shot through my front window, because the chance of finding that person, unless he bragged about it in a bar or something, they're just too much work. It just isn't going to happen. And so when things like that happen to me, if I didn't know exactly who did it, I didn't worry about it. I just went on, Okay, I fixed the window. Yeah, I scrubbed the markings of the firebomb off the back of my house. Luckily, I had a masonry stucco house. And that stuff doesn't burn very easy. Chief Gunn, upset by the increasing tempo of violence, warned that he had given his officers orders to shoot to kill where terrorism is involved. Well, I would think shoot to kill would be the order of anything where somebody was shooting through people's houses and stuff. I mean, people do that all the time that are not so-called terrorists. That's why this hate crime stuff is so ridiculous. I mean, if somebody is attacking your house or attacking you, and the police are called, the police should take care of it, regardless of what you want to call it, terrorism. That's silly. We intend to stop it, he said, and we will go to all legal lengths, use any number of men and any degree of reasonable force necessary. Anyone who burn a church or a home or shoot into somebody's home is a low down, and I can't really describe it in acceptable words. Well, I can see that if there's a family and women and kids in these buildings and houses. But if you're in a guerrilla war, which you would obviously try to not hurt women and children, or an innocent guy who's not into anything. But I don't cry over churches burning down, because Christianity is one of our worst enemies. And that may lose me a lot of support, but I'm not going to kid you. Christian religion is one of the worst problems we've got, not only here, but in Europe. It's not as much in Europe, but here in the United States. If you want to find out who the pushers of race mixing are in your community, start with the churches, because they're up to their neck in it. So if their church burns down, and if there's a reason, if the church is being used as a headquarters for nasty operations by blacks or anybody else and gets burned down, well, that's a military objective. But I wouldn't believe in destroying buildings if they could be used for our purposes later. A lot of churches are nice buildings. They can be used for other purposes, you know. In fact, every time I see a church for sale around, I'm tempted to buy it, because they're usually built better than regular buildings, and they're usually, you can get them pretty reasonable as compared to a bigger house, you know. So that's something for you to look at, because a lot of these stone and brick churches, boy, I'll tell you, there's something, make a great house or headquarters. For Meridian's beleaguered blacks, Gunn's concern was too little too late, and in any case, they did not trust him or his men. Even Dr. And that's another thing, you got to keep the other side suspicious of their own people. That's more important than so-called terrorism. That's psychological terrorism. Have all these people looking at each other, all the cops suspecting the other cops, and all the FBI guys suspecting the other FBI guys, and the other media people and reporters. Remember, I was recruited into the John Birch Society by a reporter from a Southern California newspaper. And, of course, at the time, they were acting like the John Birch Society was a terrorist outfit, which is silly, because they weren't. But a lot of people who went on to become guerrilla operation people did belong to the Klan, that's for sure. For Meridian's beleaguered blacks, Gunn's concern was too little too late. In any case, they did not trust him or his men. Well, I don't blame blacks for not trusting whites any more than I blame whites for not trusting blacks. It's just the way it is. Even Dr. Corngay, who got along well with Gunn and acted as his informal liaison to the black community, did not bother to call the police after the shooting incident. You see, I was afraid that some of them were involved, he said later. Besides, I had my Enfield rifle. Yeah, if you're going to go shoot somebody's house or shoot through a window, you got to expect them to shoot back. So a lot of Klansmen, too, and not just Klansmen, that are dumb about a lot of things. They think they can get away with stuff like that without the other party coming back at you. Well, they can find out who you are, go back and shoot up your house. So people in that kind of activity have to think about it. The culture of Meridian's blacks was as distinctive as the cultures of its Irish and Jewish communities. Partly it was a matter of education. Until the late 1940s, Meridian was the only city in East Mississippi where a black student could go to a four-year high school. In fact, it was two black four-year high schools, making it a magnet for the students from outside the area. This distinction could also be traced to the Jews. The Welsler School, dating from 1888, was the first black public school for black children in the state, and was named for a rabbi who led the drive to get it built. And from 1937 until it was desegregated in 1969, T.J. Harris Senior High was the pride of the black community. That reminds me of when we lived for a period in Florida twice. First time we went down and just spent a winter, my folks rented a cheap place to stay in. We didn't have a lot of money, but anyhow, the second time we went down and we built a bar and restaurant, a beer bar and restaurant, just a small place. The building's still there. I visited it one time. But one thing I noticed, because we went down there in the late 40s, early 50s, Dade City, Florida, was about, I think, about 25 miles north of Zephyr Hills, is the town we lived in. And I always noticed, you know, there was hardly any black schools around, but the finest school in the county was in Dade City. It was a black school, and you drive by that school, it was immaculate, and all kinds of Cadillacs in the parking lot, teachers standing in out, black students, teachers in suits and so forth like that. The white schools weren't that good. At least the ones I went to, they weren't bad, but they weren't that good either. Academically inferior, perhaps by white standards, many of its graduates nevertheless went on to become teachers, doctors, businessmen, and skilled craftsmen. Well, just remember, it comes from within. You can't pour it in through the top of the head. Either kids have that talent or they don't. Comes from edu is Latin from within. Everybody thinks that you can. The guys that are making lots of money off education always have you convinced that they can just open up the top of the head and pour knowledge in, and suddenly you'll have a brilliant student. That's all bullshit. Your creative students will create, whether you pound them full of crap or not. Blacks, of course, that urge to create can be cut off and can be stifled. That's one of the great problems among white kids. And they're not encouraged to act upon their genius. Blacks seldom found the opportunities in Meridian's limping economy, though, and quite a few went north in search of a better life. Many who left to maintain ties with their old hometown. In 1967, a group of Meridian expatriates living in Detroit got tired of bumping into each other only at funerals and formed a social club. The idea spread, going into the National Council of Meridianites, which grew to some 3,000 members with 20 chapters across the country. There's the black birth rate, baby. Meridian's black community had strong local leadership in men such as Reverend R.S. Porter, pastor of the First Union Baptist Church, Reverend Charles Johnson, pastor of the Newell Chapter Methodist Church, and businessman Charles Young, who later was elected a state representative and whose father, E.F. Young, had founded one of the country's first cosmetic lines for blacks. I've told you before, the first woman millionaire in the United States was a lady from St. Louis who developed the method of straightening kinky black hair. And she's, according to my understanding, she was the first black millionaire in the country. In 1967, it was hard to find sites for Head Start programs at First Union. The leading black church in town with 250 members, parishioner Omura Austin, said nearly half the congregation opposed using the church for that purpose. They were afraid of the church being bombed. Mostly it was older people, but some of the younger parishioners protested too. 8 or 10 members left, but Reverend Porter was a strong pastor. He pushed us in the right direction. When the civil rights leaders such as Martin Luther King came and Andrew Young came to town. Andrew Young, you know, he was the mayor of Atlanta, and he also worked with Morris Dees in the beginning in his Southern Poverty Law Center until he found out Morris Dees was a crook. Porter was always ready to put them up, First Union hosting most of the civil wrongs meetings in town. It was the site of the funeral for James Chaney, the black youth that was murdered in Philadelphia. Charles Johnson was equally fearless. Small, wiry, and dark, Johnson may have been the only person in town who had the nerve to stand up to Chief Gunn. Quote, Gunn couldn't stand the sight of him, recalls Johnson's friend Charles Young. When we had a meeting of some kind, Gunn would usually come. He would glare at Johnson and say, what are you doing here? Reverend Johnson would say, what are you doing here? They couldn't stand to be in the same room together. When the attacks on the churches began in 64, Reverend Porter organized a mutual protection society. Porter is remembered as a tough man who liked his rifle. Aside from the Deacons for Defense and Justice, the Black Protection Group that operated in Louisiana in the 60s, Porter's group in Meridian was one of the few known organizations formed by local blacks to defend themselves against Klan violence. For blacks, taking up arms was generally considered suicidal. The Meridian group was so informal it did not have a name, but its members had guns and courage. When I got word my house was going to be shot into, recalled Charles Young, everyone would be alerted and prepared with rifles and shotguns. There was no set number. My neighbors Lonnie Edwards and Rudolph Rarely used to help when I was threatened, too. They sat in the upstairs windows of my home. Sometimes they stayed with me when I sent my family away for safety. Most often, they got the call to turn out to protect Reverend Porter's First Union Baptist Church, which was so well guarded that it escaped damage. Charles Johnson's church, New Old Chapel Methodist, was not so fortunate. It had a wooden parsonage, and Johnson recalled how the Klan destroyed it in 67. Said they attempted to burn it, but a neighbor got up early, saw the fire, called the fire department, and they put it out. The second time, they torched it. Porter's men were also called on with some regularity to protect Bill Reedy, who was the only white in the self-protection group. Reedy liked to joke about surviving 18 death threats or death votes in different clavards in the East Mississippi and Alabama, but there was no denying his life was in constant danger. My preacher friends guarded my house for 5 years, he said. We used to sit up all night, many a night, waiting. Our wives had learned to make us all-night meals. You see, a lot of this, it was just too little. I mean, wrong targets. Sure, it caused a hell of a lot of uproar, but it didn't strengthen segregation at all. And it didn't cause the federal or at state level to back off. See, in these kind of deals, I keep telling you, you got to go after the problem. And the problem is not at the bottom. The problem is at the top. If the black community was armed and ready, the Jews of Meridian were dozing after a false sense of security. After the bombing of Rabbi Nussbaum's house in Jackson, Rabbi Milton Schlager warned the members of his Meridian congregation that their synagogue, also named Temple Beth Israel, might well become a Klan target too. Like Nussbaum, however, he was an outsider, a native of Revere, Massachusetts, who had served northern congregations until arriving in Meridian 5 years earlier. His warning was ridiculed. His congregation told him he did not understand that the Klan would not dare attack Meridian's Jews, because the Jews had helped found and build the town. Schlager's insistence that the danger was real only intensified their scorn. He was labeled an alarmist, a pinko, a communist, a homosexual, even a Yankee. Oh, that's the worst. His warnings were upsetting the apple cart. Members of the congregation told him and could only cause problems for the Jewish community by calling unwanted attention to it. Anyone who had examined the argument of Meridian's Jews might have realized that because Sam Bowers was not from Meridian, he was unlikely to draw a distinction between the Jewish communities in Jackson and Meridian just because a statue of Israel Marx stood on a pedestal in a Highland Park on lands Marx had given to the city of Meridian. Some of those who saw no threat represented a peculiar irony. Paula Ackerman had fled Germany with her late husband, Rabbi William Ackerman, in the late 30s. The rabbi was hired by Temple Beth Israel and served until he died in November 1950. Paula Ackerman served the temple for more than a year as an acting rabbi. Although she was not ordained and not educated as a rabbi, she was a strong personality and had learned the tenets of many rituals of Judaism from her husband. Having found refuge in a friendly southern town, Paula Ackerman refused to believe that Meridian Jews were in any danger. Another, who had escaped the Holocaust and found a haven in Meridian, was Mrs. Nellie Cass, whose daughter was married to the Ackerman's son. Mrs. Cass scoffed at the Slater's warning. A widow who operated a needlepoint store, she dismissed the idea that her beloved Meridian could experience that kind of violence that had struck the synagogue and the rabbi's house only 80 miles away. It was as though she and other Jews in Meridian refused to believe the Jackson bombings had occurred. "That kind of thing may happen in Germany," Miss Cass told Schlager, "but not here." It was like the denial of death, Schlager thought. It couldn't happen to you, only to the other person. Or was it the refusal of many German Jews to believe that they, with such deep roots in Germany, would be harmed by the Nazis? A.I.A. Rosenbaum, a prominent businessman who became close friends of the Schlagers and later was mayor of Meridian, never doubted that the Klan was capable of attacking the Jewish community. He tried to reassure the rabbi, but of what he considered an abundance of caution. Rosenbaum and his wife prepared for the possibility of violence. He had a rifle. She carried a small pistol in her purse. Let me tell you, shotgun is the best defense weapon there is, in most cases. You can't always use a shotgun. Of course, you can here in Indiana. They're now going to let you have sawed-off guns, sawed-off that you can stick in your coat, you know, very small. I can't understand why they would do that, considering the crime and the crime out of East Chicago and so forth, but they're doing it. But even at an 18.5-inch legal length shotgun, it's a hell of a weapon, far better than any pistol. As Frank Watts saw it, the Roberts brothers were the FBI's best hope. If they could be turned into informants, that could open the way to ending the violence and breaking up the Klan. To do it, Watts needed the help of Tom Hendricks, who had retired from the FBI in 62 after 25 years of service. Hendricks, a native of Bolivar County, Mississippi, lived on his pension and meager law practice. Tall, slender, and respectable, he was a nervous man who handled mostly divorce and small-time criminal cases. He did represent the notorious Robertses. However, that and the fact that Hendricks was known as a man always on the lookout for a buck is what made Watts think of calling him. If any Klansman in Meridian had credibility with Sam Bowers and could penetrate the curtain of secrecy that surrounded the innermost circles of the White Knights, it was the Roberts brothers, especially Alton Wayne, who was free on appeal bond after his conviction in connection with the killing of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. Trying to turn the Roberts brothers, Watts knew, would be a dangerous maneuver. But he wanted to close in on the cold-blooded killers, people he knew who were planning to do a number four on somebody, a complete elimination. The Roberts brothers came from dirt poor family that lived in a shack of a house down by the South Sowahee Creek. The whites who lived in the area, the only whites who lived in the area, their father, Cocky, was a city sanitation worker. In addition to Raymond and Alton Wayne, there was a brother named Lee who was a member of the Meridian Police Force. A fourth son, Lloyd, had been a likable, easygoing boy, but he was sickly most of his life and had died of leukemia in his early 20s. Alton Wayne, a hulking 6'2", 250-pound nightclub bouncer, was the meanest and toughest of the Roberts clan. Given a violent explosion of anger, he constantly picked fights and got into trouble. He was a firm believer in the axiom that whoever gets in the first punch wins the fight. So whenever he would get into an argument, he would haul off and sock somebody in the face with no warning, said one of the former high school teachers. As a senior, he played the tackle on the Meridian High School football team, which was generally one of the best teams in the state. Although a ferocious tackler, he got into so many fistfights and it cost Meridian so much yardage and penalties that at least one of his coaches considered him a net liability. He and another coach tried to talk with Roberts, but they concluded it was an exercise in futility. He did not want to be or could not be helped. One night following a game in Vicksburg, Alton Wayne spotted a youth sitting on the curb near the high school gym where a dance was being held. Recognizing him as a player for the Vicksburg High Green Wave, Robert said, "Hey, you're a greenie, aren't you?" The youth stood up and said he was. With that, Alton Wayne smashed him in the face and knocked out several teeth before leaving Vicksburg that night. Alton Wayne beat up another Vicksburg youth. His savage brawling created bad feelings between the two communities that lasted for several years. In high school, Alton Wayne would go to almost any length to get attention. Once he just sat sprawled out on the classroom floor in the 11th grade to create a ruckus. Although hardly anybody remembers him ever doing anything admirable, a former teacher recalled an incident in which a girl in his class suffered a diabetic seizure, and Alton Wayne picked her up and carried her to a teacher's lounge for treatment. He was really proud of that, the one thing you could say he was really proud of, the former teacher said. After high school, Alton Wayne joined the Marines, but in less than 2 years he was booted out with a bad conduct discharge for drunkenness, fighting, and being AWOL. He later married and went to work for a window company. In the summer of 64, when he was only 26, he and his family and his wife already had three small children, and some acquaintances were hopeful that the town's bully might be on the verge of settling down, but he took a job as a bouncer at the Skyview nightclub, a redneck hangout frequented by Klansmen and other racists and toughs. In his new job, he was exposed to a pamphlet Bowers had circulated to recruit new members for the White Knights. It is clear now that if communism is to be defeated in America, it will be done in the South, and primarily Mississippi, Bowers wrote. He said he was looking for only sober, intelligent, courageous, Christian American white men who were conscientiously and fully aware of the basic facts that their physical life and earthly destiny are absolutely bound up with the survival of this nation under God. We do not accept Jews because they reject Christ and through the machinations of their international banking cartel are at the root center of what we call communism today. We do not accept papists because they bow to a Roman dictator in direct violation of the First Commandment and the true American spirit of responsible individual liberty. We do not accept Turks, Mongols, Tartars, Orientals, Negroes, nor any other person whose native background or culture is foreign to the Anglo-Saxon system of government by responsible, free individuals, citizens. Now, I've noticed over the years many years and decades that many times the toughest talking, usually biggest guy to come around and want to join up with you is the one who usually ends up either quitting or becoming an informant or even worse. And so these guys will declare their loyalty to the death, but the ones who do that so much and love you so much supposedly and all that are the ones who usually go bad. They, in the Klan, they would last about 2, maybe 3 years, and then they would burn out. And many times, like this Tom Layden, who's got the brain cancer and who's dying, they go to work for the ADL. I always had a standing policy: if someone wanted to leave the Klan, they were free to leave the Klan as long as they didn't badmouth the Klan and work against the Klan once they were out of the Klan. But if they just wanted to resign from the Klan and go about their regular business, I never had a problem with that. Anyhow, that's a watch out for the guys who sound like they're super loyal and super patriot, and they talk about it all the time. Watch out. It's the best people are the quiet people who just day by day do their job and do a little bit every day for the white race. And they're not braggarts and all that kind of stuff. And they're not, and also they're not talking violence all the time. And a lot of these guys that end up being informants themselves talked about violence all the time while they were in. And T.J. Layden and people like that, I knew several like that, that became informants, but they also, before they became informants, they were always talking violence, non-productive violence, misdirected violence. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, and I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you understand a few points there that might save your ass in the future at some point, okay? 14.5.